blessing her. And they say, Baruch Hashem. What was her attitude to God? Was she blessed by God? No, she was cursed by God. And now they're saying, you have been blessed by God because God has given you a Goel, right? You have had a redeemer. Now, Goel is a specific term used for the one who does the Yibum, the levirate marriage. But here, Geula is looked at in its fullest sense of salvation, that God has blessed you and redeemed you. You have a redeemer. And this child will redeem you and your family, and he will be given a name in Israel, be Israel. Now, for Naomi, who thought she may never be back in Israel again, she had lost her name. She had technically lost her name. She said, don't call me by the same name. Now, what is the text saying? V'yikare shemo b'Yisrael, your Redeemer is named in Israel. V'yalach l'meshiv nefesh, and he will return your soul to you. V'chakel et savatech, he will redeem your old age. And there's lots of ways you could translate that. And go and mentions that your daughter-in-law is better to you than seven sons. An acknowledgement where they didn't even mention Ruth before. Where at the gate she was invisible, she was transparent. Here she's better than seven sons. V'tikach Naomi et hayeled. Naomi took the child. She put the child to her chest, and she was its nursemaid, right? And whatever, however you understand that, as a foster parent or omened, as a nurse. That she totally embraced the child, v'tikra'ena lo hashchenot shem lemor yulad ben lo Naomi. And the women say, a child has been born, a son has been born to Naomi, v'tikra'ena shmo Obed, hu avi Yishai avi David. So the astonishing thing is that the neighbors, the story ends with these women. Now, why does it end with these women, who are really minor characters? They're like the female chorus in a Greek play. Who are these women, and why are they significant? Why are they significant for Naomi? Right, because in this story, it's not enough to make peace with God. It's not enough that God, you found God, or you've come back to God, and you've made your peace with God. Whether you're Ruth, who's trying to locate God and find God amidst this misery, or whether it's Naomi, who's trying to make peace with God, it's not enough to find God. Because if you don't find God amongst the community of people who embrace you, what does membership mean? God translates into the way that we behave as a community of people who are God-fearers. How do we behave towards each other? And I think that's why, in many ways, this text, I'm not going to talk about the genealogy of David HaMelech, that's very significant, but in terms of the narrative itself, the narrative ends with Naomi's sense of being brought back into a community of people who bless her and acknowledge how God has blessed her life and how her life has been redeemed. If other people don't notice that redemption, do you as a person notice it in the same way? Or do we need the voice of the community to affirm our own sense of identity? Now let's look at the last woodcut, and with that we'll end. Now the last woodcut is much more challenging in many ways because we have a lot of people in this picture. Who's lying in the bed? Ruth. And you've got the women, and you've got a sense on the right-hand side of a younger woman, and their garments are black and white. They're not as heavy as the black garments. Naomi has not taken off her garments of mourning, and there are two older women there, presumably a woman who may have befriended Naomi, someone who's Naomi's age, holding a towel or a blanket, and Naomi, whose wrinkles had really, her whole face was weeping, is now smiling at the small white bundle that is her Goel, that brings her, redeems her name in Israel. And so what the artist has done, and notice, there are windows in the background of the woodcut, a sense of, you know, life and the, you know, looking outside of the window, and yet there are coverings here that indicate there's a small community of women who are bringing redemption for each other. These are the Shechinot. These are the women who ask Naomi initially, Hazot Naomi, who are you? And now Naomi, it's they who answer the question, right? They ask her the question, and they also help her answer the question. They tell her, Naomi, you are blessed. You have come back into the community. Your daughter-in-law is better to you than seven sons, and God has blessed you. So when we look at this book through the text and through some visualization of the text, the sense that in order for a person to fully find God, they have to really fully locate God within a community of people who accept them, who help them identify themselves as God-fearers and God-believers, and who help bring the divine presence into a group of people. And I hope that's a redemptive message for all of us. It's not enough to find God. We have to find God by reaching out to other people. Thank you.
Had questions throughout the evening, but if anybody has any questions they want to ask, feel free to do so. And maybe is the mic on yet?
You can talk into the mic just for the purposes of our
I have a nagging feeling that there's something more to this community rejection and acceptance. I think that maybe we have to look at the motivation of these women and their rejection and then their acceptance. And I think that perhaps the motivation is status. When Naomi returns to Beit Lechem, she has lost her status. Through Boaz, she has regained her status. And I think this is something that is not alien to any community, that it is it's not alien to our understanding that people will reject someone whom they perceive as being lower than they are, or who they perhaps feel has rightfully lost their position in the community. Oh, she was rich and she was this and that, that they were leaders in the community, and now look at them. Now look what's become of her. And they weren't about to change that situation. But when she regained her status through Boaz, then it was a different story. I'd like your comments on that.
You know, living in a community has its pluses and its minuses. And certainly status is an important thing in community, and people do lose status. Two interesting things come to mind. You know, when a person loses his or her wealth, the obligation of the community is actually to return them to a position of former wealth, even though, really legally speaking, we should give them whatever they need to subsist. The idea is that you are responsible for returning their dignity, which I think is a legal statement saying we're not the judge of what someone's status is. Another thing that comes to mind in your comment is Rav Ephraim Lunshitz, the Kli Yakar, was a 16th century Polish exegete. And in one place, I believe in Devarim, where there's a pasuk about charity, about tzedakah, where the person who you're giving to is called your brother. So the Kli Yakar says, why is he your brother? He doesn't have the same financial status as you. You could support him, and he needs your support. He's not your brother. And the Rav Ephraim Lunshitz lived in a time in Poland where there were many, many wealthy Jews who worked for Polish noblemen. And one of the things that he attacked in his commentary often was wealth. He was very disturbed by the way that wealth was changing the nature of the community. And he said, no, he is your brother, because money is not enough to distinguish people, because one day you may lose your money and you'll be just like him. In the sense that if money is the only determinant of status, it's too superficial a determinant, because one day you can have it and one day you'll lose it. And how does status play out when things are lost in that way? But you know, it's funny. I a few weeks ago, I was at the George Washington University Hillel. There was a large evening on women and health and spirituality. And a young woman got up and she was complaining that she was single and she really doesn't like it when she's in a Jewish community. Everybody's always setting her up. She doesn't like it. Everyone's in her business all the time. What do they need to know? Her mother and her grandparents and friends. And she always feels broken that people are trying to fix her up. Right? So people were making various comments about it and sympathizing with her negativity. And I didn't feel that way. I was not feeling sympathetic. I said, you know what? What would you say if you didn't have a community of people who were looking out for you? And you know, the fact is, it's true, it can be burdensome, but let's look at the isolation of people who move into a town and no one is interested in them and no one is helping them. And I can appreciate some of her comments and some of her feelings, but sometimes that invasiveness is also a signal to us that we need to back off, but we also need to be involved. People need to be involved with each other in a community, and sometimes that can be overbearing, but sometimes it has pleasant surprises, like when they fix you up and it actually works.
But my point is that they didn't help her. They didn't help her until she got back to town.
Well, you know, we didn't do the interim two chapters. I mean, another day we'll have to do, you know, I think that there was a whole process of rebuilding herself, and I think initially you're right, that when she comes back, she is quite alienated, and maybe we have to learn, maybe she was trying to teach them, too, how alienated they had made her feel in the process. Any other observations? Yeah.
Did either woman really have a choice? Okay. In other words, for example, what was Naomi's lineage? She was called Naomi, okay, pleasant. Did she come from wealth? Did she come from riches? That she was called pleasant. Did she then shun that actively, or did she merely follow her husband, which was characteristic of the time, okay? And then again, did Ruth really have a choice? She had, in effect, shunned or perhaps been shunned as a result of her choice to marry into this family. She left her heritage. And did she really have a choice but to go with Naomi?
I don't know. I guess I think that, you know, we all have a choice in how we respond to what life deals out to us. And I think Ruth, the fact that Orpah goes back signals that really she had the same choice. And in fact, if I were to visualize the text, I would have the fork in the road, you know, and, you know, which path is she going to choose? Because it wasn't clear that there was only one path. Her sister-in-law was going back, and her mother-in-law was pushing her to go back. So perhaps that would have been the, you know, the path less taken. I think that there's a sense here that she had a choice. Naomi is not clear, but again, Vitisha Erhi, the sense that two times tragedy strikes and she remains until she gets up and goes, perhaps it would have been easier to hide out in Moab and not go back and face the music. I actually think that she took the more courageous and more difficult step in going back. You know, going back home is not always easy for people. You know, especially with this span of distance and all these life experiences that have happened, I'm not sure that it isn't more alienating to go home than to go to another foreign country, you know, and reintroduce yourself and say, you know, I'm not the same person. You know, sometimes you see people at thank God I've never been to a reunion, but they tell me in reunions, you know, you see people and they treat you as if 15 years hasn't gone by, 20 years, 25 years, that you're all the same people, and there are people who want to tell you, I'm not the kid you thought I was in high school, or I'm just not that person anymore. You know, the wisdom of life and experience changes people, and I think everybody has a choice in how they respond. I think they did. I think the women had a choice in the way they accepted Naomi or rejected her, and that undergoes a transformation. And what's astonishing to me is that Ruth is such a short book. It's hard to believe that in four chapters there's been so much journeying and so much life transition and so much redemption. And that to me is, and not only that, but we end with the genealogy of David HaMelech, so we're traveling even further in time and history. Yeah.
Shock and that devastation of being at the burial of your two children. children is so deep. And somebody made a Holocaust reference before. It's so interesting that when you're around survivors, the only time you sort of see their smile is really at the birth of your grandchildren. So this idea that Naomi finally could re-enter the Jewish community through sort of a foster grandchild seems to me that there are times when you have this devastation in your life and eventually you can come back into the community, but it seems like it's a long, drawn-out process.
Well, I think you hit the nail on the head in terms of understanding the role of children in the process of loss and redemption. You know, that for her the ultimate loss was losing children and the ultimate redemption was the birth of the child. You know, I can't really speak in terms of experience for Afrashem. I wouldn't even dare to go there psychologically of what, you know, who could measure a greater loss. But I will say, Philip Aries in the 60s wrote a book on the history of childhood, and around that time there were a lot of studies of attitudes to children in the medieval, in ancient history and in medieval history. Now, because the infant mortality rate was much, much higher, the question arose as to whether people treated children like children because they knew that the possibility of losing children was so great. In fact, there are questions in Jewish law. Efrain Kanefogel, professor at Yeshiva University, wrote a book, and in that book he deals with education and childhood in the medieval period. And he writes that contrary to many other medieval frameworks, that Jewish people did play with their children, played games with their children. We have all kinds of recorded testimonies about children in responsa literature as a way of suggesting that even though contemporary historians have, and again, his work actually, Aries' work was caused quite a controversy, and people argued with him about people not loving their children because they were going to lose their children. Maybe that wasn't the case, and hopefully that wasn't the case in Jewish history. But I think it's an interesting question of whether or not people almost prepared themselves for the loss of children, or sometimes had many, many more children, knowing that they may have lost children. So I think it's very hard to understand how people prepared themselves for that. Any of you have read Gluckel of Hamelin? The memoir in the 1600s of a woman living in Germany who loses several children, loses her husband. I mean, it's remarkable. I mean, it's really remarkable. And if you have an opportunity, you should take it out and read it. Why this woman writes this? She begins writing. She says as a way of giving her some comfort after the loss of her husband. But she really takes you through a real roller coaster of emotions, and almost distances herself because understanding was people didn't live that long, children often didn't make it, disease took people very quickly, and it's painful. Maybe people were more prepared than we are today. I don't know. But I hope none of us have to know that. Anyone a more optimistic question? I don't like the end. I like the happy ending, right? I told you, I like the happy ending. Yeah, please. What do you think? That's a very teacher approach, isn't it? I think it is a story of Naomi. I think. I mean, I think that Ruth is the one who makes the more remarkable journey. But Ruth is, you know, in literature we have static characters and dynamic characters. And it's so funny when you look at different biblical books how this plays out. Because, for example, in the book of Esther, Haman is a static character. He's always going to be bad. Mordechai is a static character. He's always going to be good. In fact, if you look at the way Mordechai is placed in the Sefer, he's almost always at the Shar HaMelech, right? You almost even know where he is. He's a good guy. You know where he is. Haman is always the bad guy. You always know he's going to do the wrong thing. And Esther and Achashverosh are really the dynamic characters. If you don't have the static characters, it's very hard to play up the dynamic characters. And I think that in Ruth and Boaz are the static characters. Boaz is always good. He's always loyal. He always does right by his workers. I mean, he does right by people. We come to expect every time we see his name that he is going to be, as we are told, that he's going to behave as an Ish Chayil, as a Gibur Chayil. We expect that. And I think Ruth, the same thing. We never have a moment where we doubt Ruth's fidelity or her industry or her commitment to her mother-in-law and her self-sacrifice, her mesirat nefesh. There's never a moment where we question that. With Naomi, we're not really sure from the beginning of the book where she's going to go, if she'll make her way back to her friends, if she'll make her way back to God. And so on one level, I guess Ruth has the grander story of coming from Moab and making those enormous changes. I think Naomi has the real internal conflict that makes the story so interesting. So I think it works best when they're together. But I guess they didn't ask me if I would name the book, but I probably would have gone with Naomi. Okay.
My brother, who's known Erica, as she mentioned, it's the longest in our family. I'll call on him to say a few words of thanks.
As mentioned, we go back a little while. This, I think, is the first time I've actually heard her formally speak. I can tell you from many years ago, I knew she could give talks like this just from our conversations on all types of religious and other issues. Back when she was in Stern, she was known as really one of the brightest students there. You have to realize also, at that time, it's not so long ago, that's not that, we're still young, right? Still very young. We're getting younger, in fact. Very young, exactly. But women's learning hadn't exploded in the same way as it has over the last about 10, 15 years in terms of all of the institutions of higher learning, both in Israel and in New York and other places, in Toronto also, other places. And Erica, I think, really was one of on the vanguard in terms of really developing women's learning and really becoming a role model, I think, for many people. She taught in Israel, I think it was mentioned before as well, and she's taught all over the place. And I think you really got a wonderful opportunity. Again, the first time that I've heard her formally speak, and I think are kind of blown away in terms of both her presentation and obviously the substance that there was there gave us a lot to think about with a beautiful combination and balance of humor and insight and seriousness about some very serious issues. So on behalf of my family, everyone here, I just wanted to thank Erica for a wonderful introduction to Chag HaShavuot. We should all, as we approach it the next couple of days, we should all re-accept the Torah, and hopefully through that coming together, learning the lessons that we had within Ruth of fidelity to one another, to the Jewish people. We should all feel part of the community, accept HaKadosh Baruch Hu, find him, and really have a wonderful Chag that will be a wonderful beginning for many great things to come. So, thank you.
Are you invited to have coffee and refreshments? We'll Dov and Mariv in 7 minutes upstairs. And if anybody would like to join our email list who's not yet on it, please sign in the front. You'll get the weekly Dvar Torah program. And thank you.